So I'm Massimo Poesio. I am, well, dividing my time between the University of Trent and the University of Essex. And I'm going to talk about, so this is going to be a series of three lectures talking about how to use corpora to investigate anaphora. And anaphora being a particular type of context dependence. I don't know if you can actually see what I have here, which is a transcript of one of the Train's dialogues collected at the University of Rochester about 10 years ago. And so we'll talk about the Train's dialogues quite a lot through the, especially today. So this is a conversation between two people trying to make a plan to transport the goods from one place to the other. And so, like all forms of natural language, this dialogue contains a lot of expressions whose interpretation depends on the context, so you cannot understand what it means without having a context. So it is an expression whose meaning is not dictated by the lexicon, but is somehow dictated by the context. And there is all sorts of expressions of that type in language. Pronouns being an example, definite descriptions, certain types are an example. Demonstratives are another one. We'll talk a little bit more about what types of anaphoric expressions there are, but you can already see that, well, you cannot actually probably understand from this, but in this case, it is recovering its meaning from the linguistic context. The tanker actually refers to an object which is in the visual scene, which has not been mentioned before. The participants of conversation have a little map in front of them. That here is again an expression that recovers its meaning from the linguistic context, but the linguistic context, there is no nominal expression which introduced the object. So the anaphoric expressions are sort of like, there is a variety of anaphoric expressions that take their meaning from in a variety of ways from context. And so we'll try to clarify that because, I mean, almost every expression in natural language depends to some extent on the context. So studying context dependence is crucial for as a linguistic task, but it's also useful for many applications. So, for example, in information extraction, you often want to recognize what expressions are mentions of the same object. So, if you're trying to collect properties about this object, in multimodal interfaces, you may want to understand which particular object in the scene the user wants the system to do something about. In these lectures, however, I will focus particularly on, first of all, on nominal expressions, not on all types of context-dependent dependence, and also on nominal expressions that take their meaning from the linguistic context. And I use the term anaphora for that. I will talk again about my use of the terms a little bit later, but that's just for the moment, should be enough. So, as I said, there are going to be three lectures, sort of like a little series. Today, talk about how to annotate this kind of information in corpora. Tomorrow, we'll talk about a sort of linguistic use of this kind of annotation. We have carried out a series of studies on local and global salience, and so we'll talk about those tomorrow using these corpora. And on Friday, instead, I'll look at a little bit more the system building applications of this kind of work. So, how you can use this corpora to investigate anaphora resolution and the kind of problems that you encounter. So, today, annotation. Why do you want to annotate this kind of information? Linguistic research, and a lot of this kind of research is carried out here. It has been carried out elsewhere as well. For example, work on information structure, or the pragmatics of certain types of nominal expressions. And as I said, we'll show an example of that tomorrow, our own work. From the system building point of view, you want to be able to use these corpora to evaluate your systems for an alpha resolution so that you can develop for the application that I was just talking about. So in when you talk about annotating corpora for anaphoric information, there is sort of like a minimal level of information that you want to capture, and this is the fact that there are expressions which are mentions of the same object, and they form what is typically called as a chain. So here we are talking about somebody somebody works for an insurance company called Tony Johnson, and the pronoun she here is again a mention of the same object, and the same this pronoun here, she again, is a mention of exactly the same object. So this is what is a chain of mentions, and a typical text contains a certain number of these chains. So here is another chain. So we have here we are introducing a home, and then which is referred again using the expression the house, and then the 8-year-old house, and so forth. So all of these links that I've shown here are cases in which you are using the expression literally refers to the same object as the previous element of the chain, but context dependence, as we'll see, does not include only cases in which you are referring to exact same object, but also cases like this one. The kitchen here has not been mentioned before, but is part of an object which has been mentioned before, the house. So this is a so-called associative kind of anaphora, or also called sometimes bridging. It is a type of bridging reference. We'll talk a little bit about that. So almost every study of anaphoric information in corpora tries to do this kind of establish these chains. Not all studies try to do this part as well. And that's sort of the, so in a sense, the crucial problem with this kind of work. Even though there is lots of disagreement about syntax, more or less everybody agrees that, you know, the information about constituency is important, and more or less everybody agrees what the constituents are. And more or less everybody agrees that you want to construct certain types of, be able to establish certain types of syntactic structure. With context dependence, it's not so much the case. There is lots and lots of different types of context dependence. There is lots of different theories about how context dependence works. And so one of the themes of today's lecture is going to be that, illustrate how different types of annotation have identified, which types of anaphoric annotation have been done for which purposes. For example, not all studies, in fact, very few large-scale annotation exercises annotated this the last type of anaphoric link that I was just mentioning, these bridging references. There are indeed some studies of context dependence, like the map task annotation, which do not even annotate coreference links. They only look at so-called exophora reference to objects. And there is also some deep theoretical discussions about what should be the underlying model of what you're doing, and I'll try to clarify a little bit that. So in this is a sort of like an illustration of the kind of problems, the kind of choices that you have to make when you want to annotate context dependence, even in a, well, these are all examples from the Wall Street Journal section of the Penn Tree Bank. So a corpus which a lot of people think, you know, it's a useful corpus to work with. So in this example here, you have sort of like a simple cases of context dependence. We have again a pronoun here. The antecedent is probably the investors and professional money managers. Notice, however, that we have a conjunction here. So there is a little bit of a question there, what to do with these kind of cases. The agency here refers to the SEC. Again, so this is a fairly straightforward case of anaphoric link, although many systems would not be able to resolve that. But for example, you have also cases like the argument here. The argument is clear that the argument is context dependent, refers somehow to some sort of object which has been introduced as part of this sentence here. What is this object? Well, not everybody agrees on what that object is. Should we annotate this object as part of our study? Well, again, some people think yes, especially for linguistic purposes, but for applications, should you actually do that? It turns out that it's actually quite difficult to annotate this reliably. This is another theme on which we will return later in the lecture. So some people think that maybe you should, but since you cannot do it easily, it's better avoid doing this, and this is what has been done, for example, in the MAC annotation. There are all other types of context dependence. So this past summer does not refer to an object which has been introduced in the context. Is a sort of like a reference to the larger situation, if you want. Should we want to annotate it or not? For certain purposes, if you really want to annotate all context-dependent expressions, for example, for the purposes of doing intonation studies for speech synthesis, then maybe you want to do that. But for other applications, maybe you do not. I don't know, this first lecture today, unfortunately, I wasn't there. I don't know if some of these issues have been mentioned. There is all sorts of context-dependent expressions which refer not so clearly to some object. The markets, what is the market? It is also like a type of vague reference. There are very few theories that can tell you how to do that. And there is also the fact that many expressions which, like definite descriptions, which are sometimes anaphoric, they are not always anaphoric, like in this case here. So should you somehow mark especially this case as being, again, some sort of expression that you want to look at. So there's all sorts of issues to, all sorts of decisions that you have to make if you want to do this kind of annotations, like in all other kinds of annotation beyond the surface level. So today I'll try to give a little bit of background on, I don't know how many people here. Does anybody, everybody already know what the anaphoric expressions are? Do I need to give you some background on? Well, maybe not. I'll try to give a little bit of background on that. Then I'll go through some of the best known schemes for, especially for anaphoric context dependence. I'll talk primarily about cases in which the relation that we're looking at is so like identity relations, mentions of the same object, but also say something about the bridging relations. We'll talk about the problem of reliability of this type of annotation, and I don't know if we're going to have time talk about the fact that many of these expressions are actually ambiguous and about discourse deixes. So a quick survey. These are some of the anaphoric expressions. As I said, almost every type of expression can be context dependent in some way. In particular, noun phrases, nominal anaphoric expressions, that's what I'll primarily focus in this lecture. So there are the type of anaphoric expressions typically studied by linguists, like reflexives. There is, of course, pronouns, both definite, like it, them, but also indefinite pronouns, like one, Sally admired Sue's jacket, so she got one for Christmas, which does not refer to necessarily to Sue's jacket, but a jacket of the same type as the one that Sue bought. Another type of expression, of nominal expression, which is often used anaphorically, are definite descriptions. Definite descriptions, I use this term for, so like a full nominals with the definite article the, like the man here. Demonstratives are another kind of expressions often used anaphorically, as that boy here, the referring, is, which is another mention of the object Tom. And so the important thing from to keep in mind is that nominal expressions are not used in exactly the same way. So, and this is something that hopefully we'll talk about a bit more tomorrow. This is in fact one of the reasons why many linguists study, use corpora to study anaphora. So for example, here, put the apple on the napkin and then move it to the side. It seems fairly clearly to refer to the apple, whereas put the apple on the napkin and move that to the side, the that seems to be quite clearly to be referring to the napkin as opposed to the apple. So that's the difference between pronouns and demonstratives, and there are some sort of like very cute examples, the difference between pronouns and demonstratives, for example, due to Schuster. Although we will not say much about them, it's not just nominals that can be anaphoric or context-dependent. So you can have all sorts of expressions like so-called proverbs in various types of ellipses. You can also have adverbial expressions which are typically used as references to sort of like a temporal location, as in then, because of then, and or for some locative interpretation, as in the case of there. So we will not say much about that, but just keep in mind. In fact, that's one of the interesting things. Almost nobody studies these kind of non-nominal anaphoric expressions. I know of only one effort at trying to do some annotation of ellipses and studying it, which is interesting because, of course, in linguistics, actually, those are perhaps some of the most studied, among the most studied types of anaphora. So not all anaphoric expressions are nominals. Also, not all anaphoric expressions are necessarily always anaphoric. In fact, one of the hardest problems in doing anaphora resolution is you have an expression like a pronoun, and you want to try to understand whether it is in this particular use is anaphoric or not, because especially the pronoun it in English can often be used in a so-called expletive form. It is 2:30. It here does not refer to anything. It's not anaphoric. It's just a sort of like a filler that has to be there because of the requirements of English. So there has been quite a lot of work on anaphora resolution trying to develop techniques for detecting expletives. In fact, I would say that almost true that the differences in performance between different anaphora resolution systems tend to depend on how well they do at detecting expletives. So also, as I already said, not all context-dependent expressions get their interpretation from the linguistic context. Sometimes they get it from the visual situation. And this is what is called typically exophora. This is going back to the trains dialogues that I mentioned at the beginning. The participants to the trains dialogues have in front of them a map, this map here, which contains certain objects, and often when they have, they can use expressions like the orange juice factory to refer to an object which is not has not been mentioned before, but is in the map. This type of context dependence is very common in language. So this is this cute example from Jeanette Gundel. A lot of examples that I'm mentioning here, an example from Jeanette, who has been doing quite a lot of work on analyzing corpora. And we will talk the other dialogue corpus that I'll talk a little bit about today is the so-called map task corpus. So this is a corpus collected at the University of Edinburgh and Glasgow. It's a sort of like direction giving kind of task. They have to draw a route through a map like that, and the map contains lots of landmarks, as we'll see later. A lot of the context-dependent expressions in these dialogues are actually used to refer to these kind of objects that are in the scene. I already mentioned discourse deixis a couple of times. Discourse deixis is a type of context dependence that in which you use an anaphoric expression like that to refer to an object which has not been mentioned previously, with has not been introduced using a nominal expression, but as in this case, well, arguably the antecedent of that here is, I don't know, the fact that the court does not believe her. So the fact that the court does not believe her resolves the matter. That's also like a paraphrase of that. So notice that if you are doing a simple type of anaphoric annotation in which you try to mark the antecedent of that, you'll find that there is no linguistic expression that precisely expresses this precisely corresponds to the antecedent of that expression. Whereas a lot of pronouns are, well, pronominal forms are actually expletives, so they don't really have any interpretation. A lot of definite descriptions in corpora are not anaphoric. They are not meaningless, as in the case of expletives, but they do not refer to an object which has already been mentioned, as in this, again, this is another example from the trains dialogues. So yeah, I want to determine the maximum number of boxcars of oranges that I can get to Bath by 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. This number has not been mentioned before. It is introduced using, however, a type of nominal expressions, which is often used anaphorically. Again, as in the case of pronouns, part of the problem in trying to resolve this kind of expressions is to try to recognize, even though definite descriptions are often anaphoric, in fact, in many linguistic theories of the 80s, it was sort of like a part of the meaning of the definite article that it was anaphoric. In fact, it turns out that, well, our own little studies, for example, showed that in our corpus, more than 50% of all definite descriptions are not anaphoric in it. They are first mentioned introductions of an object. So one of the problems that, so these cases are a problem not just for the, you're trying to resolve, for building a system, but also for the annotators. So if you're not careful with your guidelines, you'll often find that, well, for example, there are some of our annotators that like to always mark pronouns as anaphoric, whether in fact they are anaphoric or not. They really like to find some sort of antecedent, even for many forms that we will consider expletives. Okay. So these anaphoric expressions can refer to a variety of objects, some introduced in the linguistic context, some introduced in the visual situation, some introduced in a sort of like implicit way, like discourse deixis. Then the relation between the anaphoric expression and the let's call it antecedent, is also not always the same. So the simplest case is the what we call identity of reference, when you have an anaphoric expression that is refers to the same object as its antecedent. Ross bought a radiometer and gave it to Nadia. It is a mention of the same object that we were talking about here. We already saw an example of anaphoric expression in which that's not the case. So Sally admired Sue's jacket, so she got one for Christmas. One does not refer to Sue's jacket, but to the type. So basically, Sally got a jacket like the one that Sue bought for Christmas. So we're not here talking about the same object, we're talking about the same type. This can be done, in fact, there are some cases this can be done also with definite pronouns. This is a class of pronouns called the paycheck pronouns. And we also talked about already about associative or indirect anaphoric relations, like the relation between the house and the kitchen in the very first example. So this is the example that we had. So the kitchen here intuitively is in some sense depend on the house. If we didn't know what house was, we couldn't understand what kitchen are we talking about, but it's clearly not the same object. This is a part of the same object. Just to reiterate, and this is actually sort of like important to motivate the kind of models that underlie at least the kind of annotation that we do. It's not always the case that even if you're just concentrating on nominal anaphoric expressions, it's not always the case that the anaphoric expression refers to an object which has already been introduced with another nominal expression. So in this case here, of the case of plurals, for example, John and Mary are a nice couple. They met in Alaska. They refers to object which is sort of like, you know, the set of John and Mary. In this case, it has already been mentioned. But here, John introduced Bill to Mary. They again refers to John, Bill, and Mary, but there is no nominal expression that introduces the set. You, in some sense, you have to construct the set out of the objects which have been mentioned if you want to understand how that works. And we already talked about the case of deixis. Again, is another case in which the anaphoric expression does not refer to an object which has been introduced using explicitly a linguistic expression. Okay, so quick end of the quick survey of anaphoric expressions. Any questions about this? This is a question.
Just your last example, John introduced the song, built to Mary. There's no reference to Paul. They are all friends. Because Paul wasn't there, now they are friends, it would mean something different.
Ah, yes. Well, if you didn't have all, then you wouldn't know. Sorry, did you hear the question? So the question is, without the all, this sentence here changes the meaning, and so the they is not necessarily so clear whether it refers to John, Bill, and Mary, or John and Bill, or Bill and Mary. That's your point. Yes, that's true. And so, in fact, the people who develop these examples have all sorts of cute examples of cases in which, well, it's clear, but there are some readings that are ruled out, other readings that are actually not.
My question was, shouldn't there be some co-reference from
they
and all?
Oh, I see. So you would want to mark the fact, so all is some sort of like disambiguating factor. It tells you that the antecedent. Well, people tend to say that, there is some interesting question here. So some people would say, Doughty, for example, had a theory in which all is a sort of like a floating element. So in a sense, for Doughty, it should be possible to interpret these as equivalent now. Now all of them are friends, and so all and they are in a sense part of the anaphoric expression. Yeah, that could be, could make sense. Most people just say that, well, this is a feature, so if you have that feature as part of your sentence, then it's going to be helping you in interpreting.
I assume the same sort of thing if you have each and every. I mean, we've already seen one as a quantifier already.
Yeah. Yes. So there are lots of anaphoric uses of each. So I've tried to stay away from quantifiers here because it's one of the cases that is somehow quantifiers are typically context dependent in some way. It's not easy to mark them, but yes, very interesting topics. But yeah, that sort of like belongs to the. A lot of people would like to be able to do these kind of things, but they don't know quite how. Right. So this is a point which I think has already been made before in this in the series of the other lectures. I don't think that, okay, so corpus annotation, in a way, you want to use corpus annotation as a way to support your research. So you want to study anaphora, and you want to develop a theory of anaphoric interpretation, and so you annotate the corpus to provide you with data that you, that's one reason for doing the annotation. However, you cannot really do this annotation completely pre-theoretically, in the same way that you cannot run a psychological experiment without having any idea of what it is that you're looking for. So you need something like that for anaphora, just like you need it for semantic roles and for other types of linguistic information. The problem with context dependence is that there is lots of arguments between theoreticians about what is the best framework to study context dependence. And there are some people who think that anaphora is all a purely surfacey phenomenon, other people who think it's more semantic. Whatever you do, you need to have some clarify to yourself what is your what are underlying theoretical assumptions. Otherwise, you're going to just do a lot of annotation without, and then it's going to be just throw it away. Our own work is based on this framework, which is sort of like the standard framework to the extent that there is a standard framework for discourse modeling, the so-called dynamic theories of discourse models, which have been developed starting from the 70s by Kartunen, Heim, Kamp and Ryle, and so forth. So what does it mean, having a theory of the discourse model? Well, and especially a dynamic theory of discourse model, well, the idea is that when you hear a sentence or bits of utterances like "we are gonna take engine E3 and show it to Corning," you're interpreting this with reference to a context, and the context could be as complicated as you want. But at the very least, you have to record there the fact that you've mentioned some objects have been mentioned. So, take engine E3. So you start with a context. Well, context is never empty, but you add to this context the information that we have encountered an object, which is engine E3. We have going to take that engine, and I'm really using a very, very vanilla form of semantics, trying to avoid all sorts of complexities. And then you encounter "shove it to Corning." So you... you encounter this "it," so you introduce a new discourse entity, DE2. You have to try to find what is the antecedent of that, and you look for the antecedent in this discourse model that you have built, and then you add to that model Corning, and then you add to that, for example, assuming that you realize that the DE2 here refers to engine E3, then you add to your discourse model that information, and you add the information that you're going to show it to Corning. So the terminology, when I mean discourse entities, this is what I mean, objects that you add to your discourse model, which may or may not correspond to objects in the real world, and to which you keep adding. An important property of one of the main reasons why people said that you have something like that is that, as those examples that I already mentioning, in which you, so if you're, all you do for an interpreting anaphoric expressions is working at the level of the syntax or even at the level of the strings, so it would be difficult to explain what is the antecedent of they here unless you have some sort of like non-contiguous antecedent. In a discourse model kind of story, what you say is that, well, John introduced Bill to Mary, then you encounter a plural expression. By magic or by some sort of story, you go and add to your context a new object, a new plural object, which in this case, let's say, it refers to the sum of, is the set of John, Bill, and Mary, and you interpret the they as referring to that. So basically, the discourse model does not contain only objects which have explicitly been mentioned, but also all sorts of objects that get added as you process the text. And the same thing for discourse deixis. When you encounter that, well, you are going to your discourse model, you're going to add the information that there is a certain proposition that the court does not believe her, whoever her is. That also is an object that gets added to your discourse model, and that's what the antecedent of that is. Is it clear, this notion of explicit and implicit and discourse models? Okay. And so basically, if you assume a model like that, then sort of like the terminology that I've been using so far is that, so what does it mean for an object, for an expression to be context dependent? Well, in the sort of like narrow sense that we're using here, it means somehow the semantics of that expression depends on the, some discourse entity which is introduced in a context. To understand what the meaning of that expression is, you have to find a discourse entity or more than one discourse entity in the context, and somehow that becomes included in the meaning of your context-dependent expression. What we mean by anaphora is that an anaphoric expression is an expression which is linked by a non-explicit relation, meaning the, this is important, the relation is not expressed explicitly by the text. So if you have, for example, the kitchen of the house, that's not considered to be an anaphora because your text tells you which kitchen are you talking about. But so you have an anaphora when you somehow have to recover the link to some discourse entity from the context. So this is what they call discourse model-based definition as opposed to textual definition, which is a definition in which an anaphoric expression is an expression which is somehow linked to some expression introduced in the previous linguistic context at the surface level. And I personally believe that that's not a definition that you can use as a basis for an annotation effort, because that would mean that there is an anaphoric expression in the context, for example, that you're going to use as the antecedent, meaning that you always have to mark the closest antecedent for anaphoric expression, and I don't think that that's possible. We will see later what I mean by that. Also, so apart from this distinction between semantically based and textual based for anaphora, it's also important to make a distinction between anaphora and coreference. So you can have all sorts of anaphoric links. Okay, what I mean by coreference is that two expressions denote the same object in the world. And so you can have all sorts of cases of context dependence or linguistic context dependence in which there is no reference to the same object. We already saw an example there. John bought a shirt and Bill got one. So this is a case of anaphora but no coreference because one does not refer to the same shirt. It's just it's sort of like the same type of object, but it's clearly linked to the entity introduced here. And vice versa, you can have all sorts of cases in which you have coreference but no anaphora. And the typical example is when you are working with multiple documents, and so we are talking about the same object in different documents, and so you want to say that the mention of Massimo Poesio in this document is coreferent with the mention of Massimo Poesio in this other document, but there is no anaphoric link, so each document does not depend on other documents for their interpretation. And this is, I'm sort of like banging on a little bit about this, because this is something that keeps going on, coming on and on in the discussions on annotation of anaphora and coreference, and so there are sort of like basic distinctions that have to be clear so far. Okay, so that was that for terminology, linguistic background, and now coming to the coding schemes for context dependence. I'll just briefly go through the coding scheme for the map task, which is the one example of non-linguistic context dependence which has been attempted. Actually, there have been a lot of other studies, but this is one, perhaps the most famous. We'll talk about the MAC scheme, which is perhaps the most famous and most popular scheme for annotating linguistic context dependence. And then I'll go on and on for a while about our own work in these other type of projects. And again, hopefully I will have time to talk about some of the most interesting work on annotating coreferences being done right here. So I'll hopefully talk about that. Okay, so as I said before, for the case of anaphora or context dependence, it very much matters what is it that you are trying to study, what kind of application you are interested in. So depending on your goal, you're going to come up with different types of annotation. So for example, most proposals just work on nominal anaphoric expressions. I know only of Dan Hart that done some work on annotating ellipses, but that's the only work that I know. There was a very old work by University of Lancaster. Almost all types of context-dependent annotation focus on identity relations because those are the easiest case. Some of the schemes that we'll talk about today talk about also bridging relations or associative relations. So that's the main type of difference between schemes. And there is also difference in the coding instructions. So for some schemes identify markables differently. The markables are the elements which are object of study. So the anaphoric expressions and their antecedents. And there are also some differences at the sort of like level of implementation. Although these days, since at least the map task effort, almost every coding scheme is based on SGML or XML, but they're used differently. Okay, so I'll try to highlight those differences between the coding schemes. Map task reference coding is a coding of a reference to the landmarks. So remember the map task I mentioned before, these dialogues between two people, one of them is giving instruction to the other to follow a particular route, and the other one is trying to reproduce the route in this map, which contains certain landmarks. The goal of this coding scheme was to identify all the references to the landmarks. So there, in this example, have you got a rope bridge? This is a landmark. And then they mention, okay, so there was the rope bridge, that, and so forth. So this coding scheme developed by Matthew Eilert and Cathy Sotillo, only these expressions are marked, and they are marked, okay, which object is being mentioned. They were interested in looking at the effect of repetitions, so how as dialogue goes along, phonetics and linguistic descriptions get shorter. So I was assuming that James Pustayovsky would talk about is temporal expressions. So this type of context-dependent annotation is essentially is not very different from the so-called timex markup. It's a time markup for temporal expressions. You just try to mark the timestamp. So it basically references to the real world. They use XML as a markup scheme, and I'm not aware of our formal coding manual, and we'll get back to these later. I would say that almost more important than what exactly the details of whether you use attributes or other bits for actually encoding your information, the clarity and the level of detail of your coding manual is perhaps one of the most important aspects. Sometimes it's worthwhile adopting a particular scheme. Maybe it's not ideal from a XML point of view, but if they have good coding instructions, that's probably the best thing to do. And we'll talk about coding manuals a bit later. Perhaps the most famous scheme for annotating linguistic context dependence is the so-called MAC coreference scheme, developed by Lynette Hirschman and Beth Sundheim in a series of papers. This was a scheme developed for a very specific task. Created in association with the so-called message understanding conferences, which were competitions between people developing systems for information extraction, hopefully. And so what they wanted to do was to develop resources that could be used to evaluate and train information extraction systems. So the scheme was developed, was very much targeted to that particular goal. And this is important to understand because the scheme is the most popular. Everybody uses the scheme it's just like the default scheme for annotation. It has some limitations which are heavily due to the choices that they made. So when you're trying to evaluate, you're doing coreference for the point of view of information extraction. You are trying to find all dimensions of the same objects because you're trying to collect the properties of these objects. So you want to make as many links as possible, all the properties of that object which are mentioned in the document, you would like to try to find. And so they were trying to maximize these links. Also, but at the same time, however, they had a very practical focus. They didn't have much time to develop the scheme, they wanted to do something that could be done fairly quickly and reliably. So, for example, they made a lot of choices, ignoring all the difficult cases, essentially. They nevertheless developed a very detailed coding scheme. If you ever want to write a coding scheme for linguistic context dependence, highly recommended to have a look at the document that Hirschman and Sundheim did. Lots of problems, but lots of also interesting issues come up. And so the markup scheme was SGML-based. So this is what it looked like. Well, it looks like. So you mark the expressions that you want to annotate. And this is what I meant before by markables with this coref tag. You're all familiar with XML, SGML style, kind of. So this is it's called an element. You have typically a tag. This is coref. And so the way it works is that every time that you, so the first mention of an object gets an index using the attribute ID. And then following mentions, you use this attribute here, ref, to say that, okay, this here, this pronoun, possessive pronoun here, is a mention of the same object that was introduced earlier on by this coref expression here. So coref ID equal 1, James Whitey Bulger. Here we are referring to Bulger again, so we use the attribute here, ref equal 1. Okay? So use attributes and use links. The MAC scheme, extremely popular, everybody uses it, has been nevertheless criticized by various people for a number of reasons, both from sort of like linguistic limitations and for limitations of the markup scheme. So deliberately, the markup scheme avoided what I have called before associative or bridging relations, so only identity. So if you want to study context-dependent in general, it's not very useful. There are also some problems with what it's meant by coreference here, which were discussed particularly by Van Demter and Kibble. So the problem is an old chestnut in formal semantics. So in Mac, because they want to maximize the number of properties, so if you have something like here, the stock's value was 144.5 million. 144.5 million is marked as coreferent with the stock value. So they instruct, so all these so-called predicative uses of noun phrases are marked as coreferent with that. Now, and that makes things simple and allows you to, for example, know some properties of the stock's value. On the other hand, values and temperature and all these kind of things change in value. So, for example, the stock value today is 2 euros, tomorrow will be 3 euros. If you say that the stock's value is 2 euros, so what? How do you mark the second? Are you saying that 2 is equal 3, something like that? So that's a classic problem with, and if we have time, we'll see. Well, this is one of the issues that a lot of people complain about in Mac. Now coming to our own work. So Dave, this first project on which sort of like try to develop previous coding schemes was this project called MATE. This was a European project. The goal of the project was to develop general tools for dialogue annotation, so a tool that you could use to annotate various types of information about dialogue, including dialogue acts, parsing, but also coreference. The project was sort of like an experimental. That was at the beginning of XML, so we wanted to push the sort of like the XML line and also the particular type of doing annotation with XML called standoff. I'll explain in a moment what that is, and we developed a tool for doing annotation, which was mostly a prototype tool, but in a later project called Knight, the tool was developed, and there's now a suite of tools called NXT, which is sort of like the allow you to do these different types of annotation. And incidentally, NXT is free, is one of the highly recommended tools for doing annotation, not just of coreference, but of various types of things. So just briefly, do you all know what standoff means? Standoff, if you were at James Pustyovsky's lecture on Monday, you will have heard was saying that it is today considered good practice when you do that, annotation of multiple levels to keep these levels separate. So you don't want to have a single file which contains all types of annotation. This is because, for example, if you mess up that file, then everything is screwed up. Also, you may want to work in parallel. So somebody does coreference, somebody else does dialogue acts. So what? However, you want to keep also some sort of. You need to synchronize these types of annotation. And standoff is a mechanism for doing this kind of synchronization. So what you do, what you have a so-called base level in which you have, for example, mentions of the words. And then you have all these levels, separate levels, one per type of annotation. For example, this is for dialogue acts. And these in these kind of files, you will find information about, okay, words 1 to 5 express a dialogue act of type struct. And so you have a pointer to the file, the base file, and as well as this information, but the information is kept separate. Is the concept clear? This is sort of like a pretty standard technique, but MATE was the first project in which this technique was developed. Okay, so MATE was not just about coreference, it was about all type of dialogue annotation. However, we also did some work on developing methods for annotating, and we are using here the term coreference because at the time that's what everybody used, but in fact, as you will see, we don't mean coreference in the sense of Mac. So basically the starting point for this work was this idea that I've already mentioned several times, that unlike, say, tree banking or part-of-speech tagging, it is very unlikely that you will want to do different tasks will probably require different types of context-dependent or anaphoric annotation. So what you want to have is probably different types of different type of annotation schemes. However, it would be nice if you want to develop a tool like the one that we had in mind to identify the sort of like a minimal set of primitives that you need so that you can actually develop a variety of annotation schemes. And that's basically what we did. So we developed a sort of like a we call it a meta scheme, so like a set of XML elements that you could use, and then show that you could use these primitives to do, if you want to do map task style annotation, if you want to do Mac style annotation, or whatever it is that you want to do. Now, from the point of view of the markup scheme, the crucial idea was that, well, we wanted to use standoff, but we wanted to separate the coreference links from coreference markables. What does that mean? Well, basically, what we wanted to be able to do was to be able to express different types of relations. So we'll see some examples, hopefully. So like here, in this example that we had before, John introduced Bill to Mary. Now they are all friends. There are different ways in which you can think of marking this kind of information, but one way of doing it, and that's the way that is followed in most schemes that don't like to introduce new objects, is by having multiple links. So you say, well, okay, they is related to John, is related to Bill, and is related to Mary. Okay, and all of those are elements of that. So, and that's difficult to do if you use attributes, but you can actually, if you have a separate element, in which we call the link, you can actually have multiple relations. So in this particular case, the idea was that in addition to the markables, like in Mac, the objects that mark the nominal entities which introduce objects or refer back to objects, you have this separate element called link, and you can have as many as you want, completely separate from the original expression. One of them, the first one, expresses the relation between they and John, and between they and Bill, and between they and Mary. And in general, this mechanism can also be used if you want to mark, it's a general mechanism for marking all types of semantic relations. And in fact, something like this has been used later on in ACE for marking temporal relations. Now, this idea was not our idea. This comes from the Text Encoding Initiative. The Text Encoding Initiative is a worldwide initiative to develop standards for annotating text. And as part of that, they have also developed some very, very general methods for marking relations between parts of text. For whatever reason, the Text Encoding Initiative is not tied to a particular task. But so, for example, you have a bit of text here, Jean aime Marie, and the other text, bit of text, John loves Mary, and you want to relate these two bits of text. One is the translation of the other, so you can use this link element. And so we sort of like borrowed that idea from that. Any questions? So that's what the markup for these independent links looks like in mate. In the mate scheme, you have, again, you use this DE element here to mark nominal expressions, and then you use this link to mark relations between your nominal expressions, or indeed any other type of anaphoric relation. The idea was that you could use a scheme like this to implement a variety of coreference schemes. So, for example, if you want to, for whatever reason, if you want to do max style coreference task, meaning that you want to mark precedent of dreamy detergents as somehow coreference to Henry Higgins, then you could use a link here, and you could just specify a relation ident. If you think that that's not a good idea for a variety of, if you want to have a more linguistic relation, or you want to make distinctions between predications and identity, then you may use another type of relation. And already talked about this. This is another example of case in which you may want to have multiple semantic relations. For example, you want to mark that the bronze medallion here at the same time is a mention of the object which has already been mentioned before, and also refers to an object which is part of this work there. So sometimes you may want to have both identity and bridging links with the same expression. So if the idea in keeping with the general philosophy of mate was that your coreference or anaphoric annotation would be in a separate file for coreference, which will contain the markables and the links. Another reason for having these multiple links, and this is sort of like something that we'll talk about later, maybe not if we don't have time, is the fact that you want to distinguish between the case of multiple relations, as I've mentioned, in the case in which you want to have same anaphoric expression related to different antecedents by some semantic relations, and the case of ambiguity. So just as in the case of word senses, in the case of anaphoric expressions, it's often the case you do not know what the antecedent of an expression is. And the trains dialogues that I mentioned at the beginning are sort of like they contain lots of examples like that. So you have cases like this. You have it. So we're going to take the engine E3 and shove it over to Corning, hook it up to tanker car, and send it back to Elmira. So what is the it here? Well, we actually did some experiments. So some people think that it refers to the engine E3, and other people think that it refers to the tanker car. So what to do with ambiguity is another one of the decisions that you have to make when you design a coreference scheme or a scheme for any other type of semantic relations. In Mac, there is, when you have disagreements between annotators, there is somebody called the adjudicator, which is going to tell you, okay, annotator A believes this, annotator B believes that. I'm the judge, I decide, let's go with A in this particular case. But, we believe that that's not really necessary, and so you may want to have leave the option of marking, keeping these disagreements in your annotation. And so with one of the ideas that we had in Mate, and then we sort of like adopted in later schemes, was the idea of this so-called structured link, a link which contains more than one mention of more than one antecedent. And we'll see that later, cases in which that useful. And then we introduced methods for dealing with exophora, or discourse diaxis, and we had some ideas about to deal with multiple languages. And that's more or less what Mate was. So basically just developing a set of primitives that you could use for do a variety of annotations. In a subsequent project called Gnome, what we actually tried to do was we actually tried to use this idea to do actually an annotation. And this annotation was motivated by what we were interested in sentence planning. Sentence planning is a part of natural language generation. You decide how to, what kind of text to generate starting from some semantic input. So we wanted to create a corpus that would allow us to study the factors that affect particularly which referring expression you're going to use to realize a particular object. And so we use this this corpus to study salience, and tomorrow we'll talk about in some detail about the kind of studies that we did, various types of models of statistical generation, looking at from text planning to aggregation to sentence planning, me and some colleagues. But we also used the corpus to study anaphora resolution, and that's, we'll talk about this on Friday. So those were the objectives. So what we actually wanted to do was, unlike Mac, we wanted to have a sort of like an annotation based on a fairly clean notion of discourse model. I would say that the most, however, so the main reason why I am talking about this project is today is because we actually developed, since we were doing an annotation, this was not a very big annotation, but we did develop fairly detailed instructions, and we also did a lot of agreement studies, so basically studying which type of judgments subject found easy to do. And so I will just talk about the, as far as the markup was concerned, the markup was basically just the notational variant of the Mate scheme, so I'll just concentrate on the guidelines. So as actually I thought that I would come at this point and people would have talked all the week about different types of annotation, so I would make comparisons, but in fact I think I'm the first one who talks about these kind of issues. But as those, especially those of you who have been working on the Prague dependency tree bank, well know, is that this is really, the development of good guidelines is really an essential problem in developing, in doing annotation. So you want to make sure that, well, if you get different annotators to do the task, they're going to do more or less the same thing, for express similar judgments. They have to be fairly explicit, contain lots of examples, like this is something that Martha Palmer was talking about the other day. So you want to ensure reliability. At the same time, you don't want them, I mean, for certain types of annotation, your annotators could potentially spend, you know, the rest of their lives doing the annotation. So you want to have a task which is clear and simple enough. So you have to do, for the case of coreference, some of the crucial decisions you have to make is, what do you want to count as a markable, and how do you resolve cases of ambiguity in the interpretations. And so in Gnome, what we did, well, one important caveat, so in Gnome, this annotation started in 1998, There was still wasn't really a reliable parser, so the, our markables were identified by hand. So our annotators actually had the first step was to mark all the nominal expressions. And what in Mac, for example, the not all nominal expressions count as markables, as objects that you're going to annotate. Only certain types of nominal expressions, typically pronouns and references to certain type of objects. In this project, instead, we actually wanted to treat as markables all noun phrases, including expletives. So, as we said, because we wanted to also to eventually be able to use this to study an afro resolution, so we wanted to develop models of when pronoun it is used anaphorically and when it's used vacuously. And predicative and piece were marked as markables. So our annotators basically had to go through all the noun phrases in the text, all of them, and decide, okay, is, does this refer to something or not? And if so, what is its antecedent? However, we only looked at noun phrases. We did not look at, for example, ellipses. And we did not do also cases in which the antecedent of nominal expression was abstract object, these cases of discourse deixis. We did just some informal studies, but not really a real study. So the manual you can actually find on the web. It has been on the web for quite a few years. So that was as far as basically the kind of instructions that we were giving them. But we also included all sorts of things about limiting the amount of work, and that's another important issue. So, for example, we want to make sure that every expression that is context-dependent, anaphoric in some sense, at least one antecedent would be marked, but no more than one identity link and no more than one bridging relation. And we saw before the example of they, in which there were multiple links between that and different objects which are member of the set. In those cases, we would just ask them, as long as you mark one of them, you're okay, because that would be enough to know that this is a bridging relation. We always try to get them to mark the closest previous antecedent. That didn't work out very well at all. So if you are going to do this, forget about trying to mark the closest antecedent. You can detect that automatically later. Just as long as they mark one antecedent, that's okay. And we have to try to make sure that they always mark an identity relation if there is one. Okay, and we'll see in a moment other type of limitations that we imposed on our annotation, which were motivated by this idea of trying to get an agreement on annotation. So again, I was assuming that at this point lots of people would have talked about this already, but as I said, when you want to do a coding scheme, and this is especially important if you're trying to do a large annotation project, but it's also true for a small project like this, you want to make sure that, you know, you're asking your coders to do something that they can sort of, you know, more or less agree on, because you don't want to find, you know, very strange interpretations. So now, unfortunately, whereas you can get people to agree fairly easily, but not always, on, say, judgments like, okay, what kind of part of speech tag, what kind of word this is, it's not always easy. In the case of judgments like anaphoric judgments, it's not always easy to make these judgments. So what you typically have to do, you have to start with first coding instructions, and then your annotators will have all sorts of problems, and then you revise your coding instructions. In the case of GNOME, we went through four different manuals at the distance of 6 months from each other. And as you do that, if you want to do it to have some sort of like a quantitative measure of how much agreement there is, you use some coefficient of agreement. Now, the simplest measure for agreement is the percentage agreement, which was mentioned already by Martha earlier. Percentage agreement is a very, on which percentage of all the markables the annotators agree. Is the concept clear? Now, the problem with percentage agreement is that it does not take into account the fact that you want to make sure that your annotators agree beyond randomness. And in some cases, the chances of random agreement are very high. So, and this is typically the case when you have one of the classes of objects that you're trying to annotate is overwhelmingly very, very high. So if 98% of anaphoric expressions in your corpus are actually expletives for some reason or the other, then you may get 98% of agreement, and yet you may get people to disagree crucially on that 2% of expressions, which are the ones that actually you're interested in. So this is a well-known problem. People have been trying to develop all sorts of measures that try to measure agreement above and beyond chance. And the most famous of these is the so-called kappa statistic. Kappa is used all over the place in natural language, in computational linguistics, ever since it's a very famous paper by Jean Carletta in 1996. I don't think at this point I will have time to explain the maths of kappa. So for the moment being, hopefully maybe tomorrow I will say something about it, but for the moment being, just keep in mind that kappa for most purposes takes value between 0 and 1. That's not quite correct to say that it takes value between 0 and 1. And if you get, and there are some sort of like, this is a little bit like correlations. So the what do these numbers mean? Well, for natural language purposes, most people agree that if you get a value of kappa above 0.8, you are okay. If you get a value between 0.6 and 0.8, you can sort of say there is agreement, but not be quite so confident. So now we started looking at agreement on context dependence a few years ago with my student Renata Vieira, and the very first study that we did was a study of definite descriptions from the what's the journal portion of the PEN tree bank. And so we just asked them to divide the definite descriptions in three classes: direct anaphora, cases in which the antecedent and the anaphoric expression have exactly the same head; discus new, cases in which the definite description introduces an object which has not been mentioned before; and bridging descriptions. This includes not just the associative cases that I mentioned before, the kitchen, the house, or flat, the living room, but also cases in which you have an identity relation, but the head is different. So, and we also tried to come up with a fairly broad classification of bridging relations, associative relations, and so that we could actually give our annotators all sorts of examples. So we counted cases in which the relation between the expression and the antecedent is based on some sort of like lexical relation, like part of or eponymy and so forth. Cases in which the antecedent is as different form because it's a proper name, whereas the anaphoric expression is a definite description, and a variety of other cases that, again, I getting progressively more complex. Hopefully I will have the time to go through these on Friday. Now, the important thing is to what we found is that these are very, very simple judgments. Okay, so object has been mentioned before, never been mentioned before, never been mentioned before, but somehow related to some object which has already been introduced. And yet what we got was what's called the tentative agreement for the distinction between three classes. You get a slightly better agreement value if you just ask them, okay, object we mentioned before or not? No distinction between bridging and other things. But if you also try to ask them to distinguish between, different types of first mention, things go bad again. Our subjects mostly agreed on the classification for the cases of direct anaphora, what the antecedent was, but not always. There were some interesting cases of disagreement. And for bridging descriptions in particular, in 70% of the cases of we considered bridging descriptions, they disagreed. Incidentally, this is the reason we sort of like knew that that was the case. There have been some informal experiments run as part of MAC, but they never tried to quantify it, so we did try to quantify it. So, okay, so what that meant, when we were trying to do the gnome annotation, we tried to be fairly careful. And so we did try to do bridging relations, but we were very, very restrictive about the kind of bridging associative relations that we asked our annotators to mark. So we asked them to mark identity, cases in which subsequent mentions of the same object, and then a couple of set relations element, set subset, and something which we call the generalized possession, which includes part but also physical possession. So with this distinction between four categories, what we got, so we basically, we went down from 70% disagreements to 5% disagreements on the anchors. We still had the problem that of missing relations. So if you ask people to mark bridging, they will always miss some. This is a common problem in also all type of annotation. One reason why you want to have more than one annotator going through through your text. And notice that in this case, I'm not using kappa, but I'm using percentage agreement, and there is a reason for that. So kappa works well when you're trying to do, you have a limited set of labels that you're trying to assign to your objects. Well, there are still some problems, but basically works okay. Now, in the case of what you're trying to do is to identify agreement on the antecedents, our kappa doesn't work so well. And what is the reason? Well, what would be the kind of label that you're going to assign to your anaphoric expressions? If I have time, maybe tomorrow I will go to this in a little bit more detail, but broadly speaking, what you're trying to do, the more natural way of doing this is to use the coreference chain itself as your label. So I'm saying, okay, the mentions, so I'm saying, okay, all of these objects, all of these expressions are mentions of the same object for this particular annotator. So the label for this anaphoric expression is going to be the coreference chain to which that object belongs. Let me try to explain this because I see some perplexity around. Okay. Let's use this example here. Okay. Suppose that you have this set of objects that you have marked as being part of a coreference chain. So what is the obvious label for this it here? Well, the coreference chain that this person has said. So according, this coder told me that this mention here, this expression here, the denotation, the meaning of that expression is that it belongs to coreference chain that contains objects 1, 2, 3, and 4. Is the concept clear? So, any doubts? So, what else in the case of, say, part of speech tagging, you can start with a set of labels that you're going to assign to your objects to begin with. This is a noun, adjective, whatever. In a sense, each text is its own story, each document is its own story as far as anaphora, right? So what you have to do, okay, in that document, what was the meaning of that particular anaphoric expression? And you can only say, well, the meaning of these expressions are all the mentions of that expression, so which in a sense identify a discourse entity in the sense. It's not a completely obvious concept, I realize. Okay, now what happens if you use that? Well, what typically happens is that unless your document is really, really short, as I said before, what tends to happen is that annotators forget one mention or the other. So annotator A, for example, will get 1, 2, and 4. Annotator B typically gets 1, 2, and 3. They all forget one. Okay. Now suppose that you use these labels here. The number of times that this object has been mentioned, and you use that as a label, then you would find that A and B disagree completely on an anaphora. So they do not agree on a single case. Which is kind of silly because, you know, it's clear that both of them thought that tanker 1 and tanker 2 were part of the same object. It's just so, you know, well, okay, A forgot this and B forgot that. So to measure agreement on antecedents, you need a different measure than kappa. There is such a measure which is called alpha, and I'm afraid I won't have time to talk about it today. If I have time, I'll talk about it tomorrow. It's not a perfect solution, but it is a bit of a solution. Okay, so it's time to stop. Maybe I'll continue a little bit tomorrow on this. But so let me just try to... recap some of the ideas that I mentioned today. Well, the first point that I hope I've made is that for those of you who think of anaphora as basically equivalent to the coreference task as defined in Mac, I hope that at least gave you some idea that there are other possibilities and there are other ways that one can do things. In fact, in the latest of these initiatives, there's a project called Onto Notes. They are sort of like coming around, abandoning a little bit the Mac scheme. The second point is that you can sort of do annotate context dependence for text, but you have to have, I mean, you cannot just start annotating and hope that somehow the text will give you your theoretical intuitions. You have to have some theory underlying your annotation and some goal, and you have to be quite ruthless sometimes about, okay, so I'm going to annotate this, but I'm not going to annotate that. I've only talked about few schemes. I hope tomorrow at least have time to talk about the...